Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. In this episode, we're going to be test talking with Rex Black. Rex is a legend in the testing community. He's an author of over 13 books and one of the first testing thought leaders I ever started following when I started my testing career way back in the 90s. In this episode, Rex shares all kinds of tips and tricks to help you improve your testing efforts. Check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Rex. Welcome to Test Talks.
Hey, Joe. Good to be here.
Awesome. It's an honor to have you on the show. I think I told you this in an email. One of the first books I ever bought for my testing career was Managing the Testing Process, and I think it was one of your first books.
It was indeed my first book, and if you have the one with the green cover, it's actually the first edition of the
first
book.
Nice.
Wow.
I'm missing the CD, though, unfortunately, and the CD was awesome. It had a bunch of like cool tools and utilities on it that I miss.
But you know what? Everything that was on that CD is still available to you. You can download it off our website.
Oh, excellent. I need to check that out.
Yeah, it's all there and more.
Very cool. So since then, it looks like you've been very prolific. You've written over 13 books. And today I'd like to touch on a bunch of different testing topics. And I guess before we get into it, though, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I've been in software engineering since 1983. I got started writing Fortran 77 code for financial applications running on CPM machines, believe it or not.
Wow.
8-inch floppies. good stuff. You don't diss the 8-inch floppy, because I understand that NORAD and our nuclear missile system still runs on 8-inch floppy. So, you know, there's still a mission critical part of the world
that that's true
relies on 8-inch floppies. So I got started as a programmer and moved from Fortran 77 to doing C on Unix systems. And did a bunch of that, did some Unix system administration, and I got hired to do some test automation for an independent test lab in 1987. And I've been in testing ever since. Started my own consulting company in 1994, RPCS, and we have been focused entirely on testing and quality-related consulting. And we used to do staff augmentation, but we don't do that so much anymore. It's mostly consulting, expert services, and training.
So, Rex, there's a lot there. I guess the first part that strikes me is you were a developer, and in the 80s, you got involved in automation. So, I guess, how did you make the transition, and how, you know, what did you use for automation? Did you just programming up some sort of C programming automation? Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. The good old days of automation. Back when automation was through APIs and command line interfaces, which is really, in a lot of ways, I think a much better approach to automation than the graphical user interface, because
Absolutely. They
tend to be a lot more stable.
Mm-hmm.
C programs, shell scripts of one kind or another, report based kind of stuff, you know, where you get an app to dump out a report text format, and then you use regular expression tools to search for the expected results. Really, really powerful, really maintainable. You can build some incredibly sophisticated stuff with just what's built into a Unix or Linux system.
Awesome. You know, it's almost like we've become full circle, I think, because I think GUI UI automation is a scam sometimes. Well, you don't get the benefits that you do, but you get more benefits at the API or command line level, and with continuous integration, be able to run things from the command line. And I try to get people to automate more, but automate more at the lower levels. It's almost like we're going full circle. So Interesting to know, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, that's why I said it was the good old days of automation, right? Because it's before we took this massive wrong turn in the 90s of like, oh, in order to be test automation, it really has to be, you know, using the system exactly the same way the user uses it through the UI, which is like, really? Why does that rule apply? Does that mean that unit testing isn't actually testing? I mean, integration testing isn't actually testing. Only the only real testing goes through a graphical user interface. It's silly, but I mean, that argument combined with a boatload of marketing money and sales muscle carried the day for a good 15 years.
Absolutely. And so, Rex, I'm always excited when I also talk to people that do consulting, because they seem to have a better pulse on the industry than people that work for, you know, a large company. So I'm just curious to know, for most consulting gigs, do you know what people are demanding nowadays, or what the hot trends are right now that you're getting called for?
Agile remains a challenge for a lot of organizations. How to effectively implement testing teams and testing methodologies within Agile. So, you know, get a fair amount of that. Automation is huge. A lot of questions about how to automate. You know, looking at what's broken with people's automation. The continuous integration stuff and integrating automated testing into continuous integration frameworks is a big deal. You know, a lot of people talking about DevOps, but the thing about DevOps is that it just means, it means different things to different organizations. It's sort of, DevOps seems to be where Agile was like in the early 2000s, where the only universally agreed upon meaning of Agile was, we get stuff out faster. You know, one of the interesting things that's happening, and it's been happening for a while, is the adoption of more formal approaches to testing by industries that have traditionally not been formal. So, for example, I do a lot of work lately with gaming companies. And you might think, wow, really formalized testing on gaming? Yep, sure enough. I mean, with money comes a level of seriousness, and gaming is now apparently an even bigger business than the movie business, which is one of America's biggest exports. So apparently gaming is now even bigger than that. And so what we're seeing is a real maturing of testing process with the more serious gaming companies.
Yeah, very cool. So I was just curious to know, when you get invited to a gaming company to help do some consulting, how do you drive the test plan and what the process is going to be? I mean, what's your metrics, or what do you use to get people to formalize their testing process? What do you focus on, I guess, is the question.
Well, I mean, one of the things you have to recognize is, not just gaming, but especially with gaming, is that the nature of the application changes the way that you need to approach the testing, right? So, let's say that I'm testing a FDA regulated application that tracks prescription drugs in a pharmacy, right? So I got screens of data, and I'm inputting data, and I'm clicking next, and there's all sorts of, you know, role-based security and so forth. And those tests can easily be expressed as a sequence of steps and data that goes with the steps and expected results, right? It's sort of the classic way of capturing a test case, right? Now, for a game, depending on what you're testing in that game, that may make no sense whatsoever. You know, so it's like, part of a game might include a registration component and an account management component that's very much like the pharmaceutical app that I just described, where you're walking through a sequence of screens and populating them with data and seeing various acknowledgments or rejections of the data. But for the most part, the game itself, it's not non-deterministic, because they are deterministic, but you cannot easily render the expected result into a brief 3 or 4 word description, right? Other than, you know, it should look cool and be fun to play, right? Right. So it's interesting that from a point of view of how the testing is done, you know, it has to be very different But how you measure it, how you measure the process, the same stuff applies. So, for example, this company I was working with earlier this year, one of the metrics I was looking at, a few of the metrics I was looking at, were coming straight out of their Jira bug tracking system. So we were looking at things like, hey, what's your backlog? What's the closure period, the time from discovery to resolution of bugs on average? What's your severity distributions? What are your distributions by area of the game? And does that appear to make sense? You know, it's interesting when you get into the process. There's a lot of things that are similar. I guess maybe a way of thinking about it is, you know, a dog and a person and a whale are different animals, obviously, but all three are mammals, right?
Yep.
And so, well, you gotta, of course, recognize the differences. But there are things that are true about dogs and whales and people that are true. You know, they're common across all three. And so I see that in consulting a lot, is that the commonalities are a lot greater than one might expect when you peel off some of the more obvious and superficial differences. Like, you have to document tests in very, very different ways, depending on a lot of different factors, right? So that's going to always be different, but I think you can pretty much universally say that when your bug backlog is a sizable percentage of the bugs that have been opened in a year, in other words, bugs just sit around for a long time before they get addressed, that's going to impose a drag on not just the test process, but the overall development process. And it's a sign of bad health.
You mentioned a bunch of metrics that you look at. And I'm just curious to know, you know, metrics is always a hot topic. And I think I know as I was into researching for this interview, getting ready, I noticed you had a YouTube video on stupid metric tricks. So, So I'm curious to know, what do you think are core metrics everyone should use? Or, you know, is it the same between all these different companies? Or, you know, what kind of metrics should people be focusing on, and which ones probably aren't so helpful?
Sure. So first off, I'm careful to distinguish between four types of metrics. There's what I would call project metrics, which are metrics that measure how we're progressing through the project itself. And a typical example of that in the testing world is percentage of test cases executed, passed, and failed. And then you have what I would call product metrics that are more reflective of the state of the product. So let's say that we have a metric that allows us to look at things that we want to cover in our testing, like requirements and risks and personas and supported devices and so forth. And we're able to, for each one of those coverage items, classify it as either not tested yet, tested and all the tests passed, or tested and one or more of the tests have failed. Right. And that allows me to talk about what works and what doesn't work from a product point of view. Right. And then there are what I would call people metrics that are focused on the individuals, that would include things like doing an annual skills assessment to measure people's skills growth over the course of a year. And then you have process metrics, which are metrics that look at the health of the process, like bug backlog, closure period, defect detection effectiveness, the relative cost of a defect found in system test versus the cost of a defect found in production, and so forth. So I think it's important that when you're thinking about metrics, that you be pretty clear in your head of which of those bins a metric fits into. And it can fit into more than one, but you want to be careful about, you know, what is it telling me? You know, is it telling me about the project? Is it telling me about the product? Is it telling me about people? Or is it telling me about process? So that's one key. Another key is not to have these sort of free-floating rogue metrics that you're measuring just because you always measure them, and there's no way of saying what it tells you or what you're supposed to do with it, right? So really, you want to start with the objective, what you're trying to accomplish, and your metrics should flow out of questions about how well you're accomplishing that objective. So with that said, I mean, some of the things that I would say are key metrics that from a process point of view that I like to look at in an organization are things like the backlog, things like the relative cost of defect discovery in various phases of life cycle, defect detection effectiveness, coverage numbers, how thoroughly things are being covered. And those tend to be, you know, useful across multiple organizations. Similarly, you can devise project and product metrics that are good dashboards that can be used for test status reporting. I've got an example of that on my website called the Core 4 that we built for Lowe's. And I can say who the name is because we got a release to publish an article and give a presentation on it. So that's out there. So, so there's some commonality for sure of metrics. The specific targets that you would have for them may be a little different from one organization to the next, but, you know, I think the metrics themselves, there tends to be sort of a core set. Now, that talk that you mentioned, one of the specific things I was talking about there, the stupid metrics tricks, had to do with confusion about the distinction between a process metric or project or product metric and people metrics. So it was a classic. I did in that presentation, you'll see that I do the Deming red bead experiment. Which is all about that, you know, organizations holding people accountable for process capability metrics. So that's something I want to emphasize to clients, you know, and I gave that same talk in Moscow at a conference last year, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, well, that was a good presentation of it, but you know, I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. And I said, I use slightly more colorful language than I'm about to use, but I said, if it's so damn obvious, how come I see people making that same mistake over and over again every year?
Yep.
You know, so if I have to get up and stand in front of a crowd of 500 people every year and say things that are completely obvious, I'll do that until they stop happening. You know, I mean, seriously, every year I can go into at least one organization and find an instance where they are making one of those mistakes that I talk about in that presentation. Another classic one is the taking the testing pyramid literally.
Mm.
Right. So I go into organizations and they'll be like, well, you know, we have 57,252 automated unit tests. And we've got 372 automated system tests. So we're perfectly on target for the test pyramid. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you actually comparing numbers that have entirely different units? I mean, do you do comparisons of temperature based on some Celsius readings and some Fahrenheit readings? You know? So it's an obvious thing again, but you know, I think people tend to do dumb things with metrics, and they may be obvious, but they still do them.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Now, it may be obvious to someone that's a tester or a developer, but for some reason doesn't bubble up to management. So is that a breakdown on a tester's part? Isn't it up to us to educate on management, or what do you think's happening there?
Well, okay, so I think part of the problem in some areas of testing is that there was a group of people who have been influential in the field that basically I would boil down their argument. They probably wouldn't accept this as a summation of it, but I would boil down their argument to be as follows. Metrics are hard to do right. Metrics, when done wrong, are dangerous. Therefore, let's not do metrics. So I agree with one, and I agree with two, and I utterly reject three. Okay, just because something's hard to do right, and just because something can be misused, is not a justification for not trying it. And I think that's part of the problem is that there has been this sort of disdain for metrics among some people in the testing world that has not been helpful, because people want metrics. They're going to have metrics to run a business. And we can't sit on the sidelines and cluck our tongues and say, oh, well, you know, that metric can be misused this way. This metric can be misused that way. And so you shouldn't use those metrics. And it's like, well, how about instead we play the hand we're dealt and we help people do better metrics. So I think, yeah, some of the breakdown has been on the side of testers sitting on their hands and not helping to find better metrics. I think another breakdown tends to be too much trees and not enough forest, where we make this mistake that I refer to as the fire hose of data. We basically go into managers and just deluge them with this infinite number of breakdowns of test case status and bug status and, 20, 30, 50 different metrics. And so I think part of what happens there is that we distract stakeholders with a level of detail that they don't need, while at the same time not giving them the higher picture that they do need, right? So again, that's on us as testers. We need to figure out how to effectively communicate our findings to stakeholders in terms they understand, not in terms that are meaningful to us. Now, you know, it's not entirely, I mean, the breakdowns aren't entirely on the tester. I mean, the misuse of metrics for sure, the taking process and project metrics and rewarding and punishing people based on those and thinking that that's going to result in the right behavior. I mean, that's a management screw up. What can you do? I mean, it's sort of tempting to want to do that scene out of Clockwork Orange where you strap the managers down in a theater and force their eyes open and make them watch Deming do the red bead experiment over and over again until they get it, you know? But of course you can't do that. They won't go along with it. It's not legal, even if you could. So, you have to just kind of go by persuasion, right? Try to educate them. Well, no, you don't want to use this metric for that. I think the thing there is too, that what I found with managers, when I push back on the misuse of a metric, they'll come back and say something along the lines of, yeah, it's imperfect, but until I've got something better, that's all I've got to use. You know, so it's really, I think, important if we as testers or software professionals in general are going to criticize the way management is using metrics, we need to be able to try to understand what they're trying to accomplish with that metric and propose a better solution, not just say, hey, stop doing that. I was doing some work with a large IT group, part of a government agency. And they were telling me that the testers were telling me that they had on their performance evaluations a target number for a number of rejected defect reports, the number of false positives. And if they went over that target number, they would get penalized on their performance evaluations. And on the development side, the developers had a target number for, I think it was severity 1 and 2 bugs. And if they went over that target number, they would get penalized. And obviously this sets up an incredibly toxic dynamic between the developers and the testers, right? Because the developer's interest, whenever a bug is filed against his or her code, is to insist vehemently that it's not a bug, it's a false positive, or it's in somebody else's code, right? And of course, it's in the tester's interest, once having filed a bug, to never admit that it's not actually a bug, right? And of course, if the tester has any doubt about whether something's a bug or not, it's in the tester's best interest not to report it. Yep. You know, so here you have two process health metrics, right? The false positive rate and a bug counts, right? bug density, effectively bug density by developer. And they're being used in this completely counterproductive way as process metrics or as people metrics, excuse me. And they're just driving all of this really counterproductive behavior. So, you know, I'm thinking, well, that's a real problem. So I was talking to the manager of this group and I explained, hey, you know, you understand what you're doing with these metrics as an organization is really not helping. And she said, well, I can get that some people might be frustrated, but the alternative for us is that we have a evaluation system that's purely subjective. And what we recognize is if we do that, then what happens is that it's all politics and favoritism, and it's difficult to avoid having personal biases show up in the evaluations, right? Because there's that thing of, you know, I like you means I'm like you, if you've heard that before.
Yep.
So she pushed back, basically saying, well, you know, what her argument boiled down to was, yeah, we get that this isn't good, but it's better than what we had before, the purely subjective way, right? So she's basically throwing it back on me, right, to say, look, if you can come up with something better than this, fine. But don't tell me to stop doing it because I know how bad it was before.
Mm.
You know, so I think that's important that if you're gonna object as a tester or as a software professional to the way a metric is being used, you better be ready to propose a better alternative, because otherwise, what's likely to happen is that management is just going to shoot you down and say, you know, okay, well, fine, we get that there's some problems with this, but you know, until you can propose something better, this is what we're doing.
Absolutely. It reminds me of a saying, you either lead, follow, or get out. So,
lead, follow, or get out of the way. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I've seen in testing is people, like, you know, standing up in front of the locomotive with their hand up in the air yelling, stop, you know, it just doesn't help. I mean, I remember running into somebody in the early 2000s who, you know, was going on and on about how critical it was to stop outsourcing of testing jobs to offshore locations. And, oh, this is horrible. And, you know, motivations of these managers are awful. And he just went on and on and on about how that was something that needed to be stopped, which to me was, you know, tantamount to standing up at a waterfall and screaming up at the water that's falling on your face to get up in the damn creek up there and stop falling off the edge of the rocks. You know, I mean, it's like, dude, it is happening, you know, and it's being driven by a whole bunch of things. And you're not addressing those things by yelling at how unfair it is that American testers are losing their jobs to people who work cheaper overseas. I think there can be a tendency to, you know, not necessarily address the reasons things are happening.
Absolutely. And for some reason also, this just reminds me of people objecting to certifications. So I know you brought up the point of people having disdain for metrics. And for some reason, every now and then I come across a thread where people are just like bashing certification. So I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are on software certification, where they fit into a tester's, I guess, development roadmap, I guess.
Sure. So, you know, I've spent a fair amount of my own volunteer time working with the ISTQB and the ASTQB defining the certification program. And so I think there's value to it. I think the way that it's been approached within the ISTQB is particularly helpful, where it's not just a once and done, but there's a whole career path that's mapped out there. As you start with the foundation level and then move up to advanced and ultimately expert levels, and there's branches on the side for specialization. So it supports the different types of things that a tester needs from a knowledge and skills point of view at the appropriate points in their career. I think the program's been designed well in that it's designed to scale. People have some objections to multiple choice exams, but the thing about a multiple choice exam is that you can offer that at a reasonable price to people around the world. And it scales very well, you know. Whereas if you wanted to do essay type of exams and those sort of things, that just, it's expensive and it doesn't scale very well. You know, so making the program accessible to a large number of people, I think is a valuable thing. Now, you know, that said, I mean, I think it's a certification is a big net positive. Some of the bashing, I think, again, is this perfect is the enemy of the good thing that I was alluding to before, of pointing out what's usually a fairly minor flaw, or not even a flaw at all, but actually a design feature in the certification and getting all bent out of shape. Like people saying, well, somebody's got a foundation certificate. That doesn't mean that they're, you know, an expert at testing, and they can't, you know, that doesn't mean they know how to do certain things. And my response is, well, of course, it's a foundation. It's meant to be an entry level certification, the first step on the path. Mm. I mean, you know, you would not expect that somebody who graduates from college with a Bachelor of Science in Engineering has the same level of expertise as somebody who's been working for Lockheed Martin building rockets for 20 years. You know, I mean, so why to think that somebody who got a foundation certificate should have the same level of skill, or that's what's being claimed as somebody who's been doing testing for 20 years? It's, you know, it doesn't make sense. So I think some of that argumentation that you get is, again, just kind of driven by this perfect is the enemy of the good problem, where, you know, minor flaws get blown out of proportion. It does seem to be dying down quite a bit, that reflexive anti-certification stuff, to the point where now I'm sort of surprised when I hear it. Not terribly surprised, but I mean, it's more unusual to hear it now than not, right? And it used to be that, you know, you could pretty much set off a bar fight at any conference venue at 9 o'clock at night by getting up in the hotel bar and saying, I'm pro certification, you know, and it's like the scene in 48 hours, you know, the bar gets torn apart, right? And now it's at the point where I actually was at a conference recently and somebody was giving a keynote speech and they used the phrase best practice and nobody even said anything. And I'm like, hey, sanity prevails.
Oh, that's such a pet peeve. If I ever write best practices in a blog post, I do get people saying, it really are no best practices. Like, oh, I know. It's just, you know, people get so touchy sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, again, this is one of these places where somebody is doing something with a phrase or an idea that is not meant to be done with it. Right. So what I always say when I'm trying to explain best practice to people is think pattern, not recipe.
Mm.
Right. So
I like that.
So yeah, that's, it took me a while to come up with that, of how to express that. But as I said, you know, if you think of a recipe, like if I give you a recipe for chocolate cake, and you get the exact ingredients that I describe and follow the exact steps that I gave you, you will produce exactly the same chocolate cake that I produce with that recipe. That's not the way to think about a best practice. You want to think about it like a pattern. And I use as an example of this, a rule that one of our clients has for their delivery drivers, which is minimize left turns. It's a best practice when doing lots of package delivery to make as few left turns as possible, because left turns take longer. So you sit idling, right? And also left turns, you're much more likely to get into an accident than a right turn. So that's a pattern, right? So it is a best practice to minimize left turns, right? It's not a recipe, because it doesn't say exactly what to do in every single situation, right? But it says when you're making choices about what to do, you know, go this way, not, you know, when you can, rather than that way. I mean, it's similar to like saying that the Agile Manifesto is a set of best practices, in the sense of it saying, you know, do more of this and less of this, you know, more interaction with people, less focus on rigid processes. You know, there you go, best practice. I set out to single-handedly, perhaps, redeem the phrase best practice when I first heard people going off on it back, you know, 15 years ago.
Yep.
And I'm like, how can you have such an amazingly violent reaction to such an anodyne phrase? And why do you think that it means recipe when nobody means it that way, mm-hmm. when they use it like that? I've challenged people to say, show me an example where somebody's using the phrase best practice to mean you always have to do something exactly this way. Right. And I've yet to have somebody be able to point me to a concrete example of that. They say, oh, yeah, I've definitely seen people do that. Oh, okay. You know, if I say I've definitely seen Sasquatch in my front yard, does that mean the Sasquatch exists? You know, I think you'd want me to actually show you a picture of me, you know, bear hugging Sasquatch in the front yard of my house before you'd believe that Sasquatch was running around there, you know?
Okay, Rex, I know as we go towards agile development, agile testing, a lot of times the roles of testers, again, morphed into developers. And I have managers a lot of times say, oh, we don't need testers anymore. We're just going to hire developers. So as testers, how do we explain to management the value that we bring or what testers actually do in their job? Because a lot of times developers are creating things that are outputted, that it's like a product that you could sell, where testers a lot of times find things that you really can't tell unless they're not doing the job. So I guess, how do you express the value of testers to management?
I think the important thing is to start with what management cares about. Let me give a couple examples here, right? So I've got a number of clients like this, but one client in particular that I'm thinking of, these guys are just all about efficiency. You know, that's the big thing for them. Save time, save money. So if I'm a tester and I'm communicating with a manager about why testing matters, I'm going to talk about things like why independent testers have a higher defect detection effectiveness than developers testing their own code, and how the cost of a defect found by an independent tester is so much less than the cost of a defect found in production, because I can relate those back to saving time and saving money. So that's likely to be an effective way of communicating about testing in that environment. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, I've got some clients that, you know, efficiency is not the big thing for them. What is the big thing for them is, are we optimizing our users' experience? Like my gaming clients tend to think this way. The successful ones are like, yeah, you know, we've got money. So we're not really so interested in saving money. If you're pitching testing as a way of saving money, they just kind of look at you like, huh? You know, it's not really our top priority. But when you start talking about testers being able to bring a different sense, a different set of assumptions, a different sense of style, a different set of opinions about how the game ought to work, as a way of sort of challenging the developers' opinions and arriving at a better consensus so that we deliver a better game to the players, right? Now you can get their attention. So I think, you know, understanding what the senior managers and executives want, and also understanding what they're afraid of, because that's another important component of it is, you know, helping them get what they want is one piece. Helping them avoid what they're afraid of is another piece of it too. You know, I had a great example of this where I was talking to a project manager and he, I asked him, do you think testing matters? Do you think testing is important? He said, oh yeah, testing is very important. He says, I have this recurring nightmare where one of my projects goes into production and it brings down the entire bank where I was working with a bank. So it brings down the entire bank. Everything's down. The branches are down. The ATM network is down. Central office is down. The mainframe is down. All everything. And I get called into the president's office, and he says, "Because it's a nightmare, I'm naked," which was, you know, a little bit too much information for me at that point. But you know, he's on a roll, and so he's like, "I'm in the president's office. I'm naked, and the president is yelling at me about how I killed the bank." And a bank's been in business for over 100 years, and I've killed the bank, single-handedly killed the bank. He says, and then I wake up, and I realize that can't happen to me because we have the QA team. The QA team protects me from that, right? So for him, the big thing was confidence. You know, QA gave him confidence that he was going to be able to go into production And, you know, it's like that saying about, you know, a good model for a QA team to use with developers is we help you look good, you know? So yeah, I think, you know, being able to communicate effectively to people outside of testing, especially up the organization and management roles and executive roles about how testing addresses both what they want and what they're afraid of is really important.
Awesome. Great stuff, Rex. Before we go, is there one piece of actual advice you can give someone to improve the testing efforts? Let us know the best way to find or contact you.
The best way to improve, well, you know, set and meet skills growth targets every quarter, I would say, would be my piece of advice. Learn something new that's important to your career. So, for example, if you're a black box tester and you don't know how to program, learn in the next 3 months, learn how to write scripts. And then the 3 months after that, learn how to program. You know, so I'd say that's probably the most important thing. It's, you know, as things continue to evolve, it's going to be important to keep up. Now, as far as ways to get in touch with me, the best way is probably like to be in regular touch would be go out to Twitter and look at the @RBCS handle and follow me there. Or you can go on Facebook, which is Testing Improved by RBCS, all one word. So those are good ways to keep in touch with me. And if you're on LinkedIn, you can connect with me on LinkedIn to send me a connection request, and I'll accept it.
Thank you, Rex, for your testing automation awesomeness. So I want to just give a quick shout out to the creator of Karate. It's a cool BDD-like open source project that allows you to write API tests using BDD-like syntax. Very cool. Check it out. So I just want to give a quick shout out to Peter Thomas. He actually messaged me on Twitter saying that a lot of people that he knows that he talks to, for some reason, testtalks.com is getting flagged as a security risk. So I didn't know what to do. I ended up trying all types of things. So now when they go to Test Talks, they no longer get that message. However, everything resolves automatically from testtalks.com to joecolantonio.com/testtalks. And I could not get the pretty links to work anymore. So now all you need to do is just head on over to testtalks.com. And in the search box, just type in the number of this episode. This episode is episode 148. If you're looking for another episode, just type in that number or type in the name of the person being interviewed and the episode should come up for you. And while you're there, make sure to click on the free trial button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with creating automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
For listening to the Test Talks podcast, head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.